Good morning and welcome to Countrywide. On the show this morning, thoroughbreds kicking up sand on Omi Strand in Connemara, the explosion in walking across the country, and the return of the Curlew Call in Leitrim. And we're on 51551 on text, countrywide at rte.ie on email. But we start with dairying. In the early 2000s, Maynooth scientist John Sweeney wrote a report about future weather changes in Ireland due to climate change. And in it, he predicted wetter, longer winters, a reduction in the number of frost days and drier summers. Well, we are seeing these changes play out. It has been a very difficult year for dairy farmers, with 9 months of wet weather, low to no grass growth and a deep concern about the autumn and winter ahead. Well, during the week, Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnellogue, advised farmers to prepare for longer winters from now on. And that'll mean they'll need to have more feed banked up and more slurry storage because animals may be housed for extended periods. Well, yesterday, I travelled to the southeast to hear from two dairy farmers about how they are responding. And I began with Kate Curran, who farms 200 cows in Port Law, County Waterford.
It's all washed up now and it's nice to be done in a lovely morning. It's nice
beautiful.
Morning this morning, yes.
And the sun is streaming in, but it has not been like that this year, has it?
No, definitely not. Like, it's been very rare for the sun to be coming out, so it's lovely when it does come out because there's not been many milkings now that you could go around in t-shirts and shorts. It was hard for the grass to grow and it's only, and even the clover wasn't really coming. Now it's only coming, like that should be coming April, May.
So we're walking down the path, your cows there, head down eating the grass. How has the year been?
The year has been really tough on us, really, on the farmers. And like, we were so lucky, here that we have, there's myself, Shane, and his dad, John. We're the three full-time on the farm. And we get a student then in the spring. So we were very lucky that we had all the help. And we just built a new calf shed there. It was just luckily finished just before the cows started calving. Really, it didn't stop raining last year. Since nearly June, you could say there was 1 week, and it's just been non-stop rain, and it's been very difficult. The cows then were in early. Obviously, it was a knock-on effect then on our fodder. So, like, we were feeding earlier in silage, and we only had budgeted really for, you know, usually a four-month winter. Like, you know, if you had it, we'd always have maybe a silage pit left over. But and as well, that's a knock-on effect then on our slurry storage, because you've had cows in earlier and you've more slurry, and then as well trying to get out onto fields, it's just been very difficult. We just did a budget there, a fodder budget, and we're stocked correct to the numbers. We've the right number of cows, and we're in a 30% deficit. But like this year, like, we had to buy in bales, we had to bring in a load of beet just to help, because like we ran out of our silage, which would never happen. So this year, like, it's just we're really budgeting really for a 6 month winter. So
Minister McConnellogue, the Minister for Agriculture, said during the week, you need to budget for 7 months now. Mm.
That's like, going forward, we hope that won't, like, we hope it'll be only maybe one in five that you're going to get something like this. But with climate change, you just have to be there and adapted. We are getting the drier summers and we are getting wetter winters and more rain. So I suppose, like, we are going to, as farmers, have to try and adapt that as best as we can.
Have you sat down and thought, right, what am I going to do?
The biggest thing that we're going to have to look at is our slurry storage. Like, on paper, we have right amount of slurry storage. But with the amount of rain that we're getting and that cattle are coming in earlier, in January, when you want to get out with your slurry, we're not able to get, like, when you want to go out, the grass is, you know, it's waterlogged. You're not able to travel on ground with that, or you're going to get stuck, basically. So you don't want to be damaging your fields. We're trying to cut back on our fertiliser. So we want to really keep that quality slurry. We don't want to be just throwing it out onto fields for just, oh, get to get it out. You want to try and keep that and use it beneficial for in the rest of the year in your farm.
So slurry storage being a big issue, because as you say, if the weather is going to be wetter, the winters are going to be longer, your cows are going to be inside for longer, which means that you need to manage that slurry. What else are you looking at?
We're nearly into August now, like next week, and we're hoping to go at second cut next week, and hopefully now the grass is starting to grow and that we get a good back end year. But if we don't, we're definitely going to be any of the cows that are not in calf, we're going to offload them earlier than we'd usually keep them. We'd sell them in January, but definitely, like, if the grass doesn't pick up, we will be offloading them. It just, we hopefully build a buffer and a surplus. That's what we're hoping to do. With climate change now, it's really hard to know.
Dairy farmer Kate Curran on how she is going to manage the winter ahead. Well, I've just jumped into the car and I'm going to drive half an hour south to Jill O'Sullivan, who is a dairy farmer outside Dungarvan. The decision that Jill and her husband Neil have taken this year is to reduce cow numbers, which brings them out of derogation, the exemption that was given to Ireland by the European Commission, which allows a small number of farmers to keep more cows per hectare than normal. For Jill, the decision is mainly about building resilience for the future.
If we model our farm on how other research farms do it, it wasn't going to work on our farm, because one thing is significant about our farm, it's on the side of a hill, is very challenged when it comes to dry periods because we have very shallow soils and they're south facing. Our farm system had to be resilient for the market pressures, so that's milk price and input costs. And secondly, our farm system had to be resilient for climate extremes, which we were seeing more of. And then thirdly, our farm had to be resilient in terms of policy direction. Our farm is very much under pressure when we get 10 dry days, which is unlike 80% of other farms in the country. Climate variability, in essence, over the next and over the last 40 years and over the next 40 years, it is what's forecast is longer dry spells, wetter winters in its most simple terms. And over the last 40 years, we've had a threefold increase globally in the number of extreme weather events. So that's storms, droughts and flooding that has occurred globally. So farmers are farming under conditions of increased risk over the last 40 years, and that will continue to impact farm businesses over the next 20, 30, 40 years, and farmers will have to adapt to that.
You wrote a piece in the Farming Independent during the week and you said when it comes to policy, specifically nitrates and reducing emissions, farmers have been asking for clarity but have been left in the dark. The wait for clarity has been difficult to bear. Can you explain a bit about that?
Every year we hear new regulations being put in. The strong cooperation measure is a really good example of how it's put in and then pulled out mid-season. And when it comes to other things that will affect how we farm at the moment is derogation. When we have such little clarity about where the derogation is going, and this because the government has to apply for a derogation to the European Commission in 2025, and we don't know what the outcome of that will be. Year in, year out, the lack of clarity around this decision is putting a lot of stress on farms. For us, docking the farm for the level of grass growth that we can manage with a particular level of nitrogen that we've managed, we've pulled nitrogen out of our farm system over the last couple of years. When we can't grow as much grass as other farms, then we can't stock as high as other farms. So that's how we end up having to, for us, to have that little bit of capacity brought into our business to reduce our stocking numbers. That's just to stock the farm appropriately for the amount of grass that we can grow.
Getting out of derogation from a point of view of paperwork, I mean, it's a regulated space. Will that free you up more as well?
Like, derogation brought huge benefits. If you look out into that field over there, Ella, you'll see that there's a water tank right in the middle of the field. You see all the water courses are fenced off. And how we apply slurry here is using low emission slurry spreading methods. And all of that stems from the positive environmental benefits of being in derogation, because you have much stricter regulation. And now that we opt out, that we're dropping out of derogation, it means that, yes, we have far less regulation, far less paperwork.
Is a lot of it trying to get ahead of the curve for you and manage some of the potential chaotic weather patterns that will be ahead because of climate change?
We started farming in 2009, 2010. But when we got to 13, I remember I was pregnant and my daughter was born in mid-July. And it was sweltering. It was the first summer that our grass growth was really challenged with the model that we were following at the time. And then again in 18, we got scolded that summer. And we said right, we need to readjust how we look at the farm in relation to these prolonged dry spells in the summer. And since 18, we've probably had a mini little dry spell. Maybe it might last probably 2 weeks of dry weather or intense heat. We definitely had one in 1920. Again, last summer was a very wet summer. So it's that variability, and trying to bring that variability into your farm planning is solely about being adaptive and having and forward planning and having that war chest on hand to deal with it. Things have had to change over the last while, and you've had to bring that capacity into the system, that resilience into the system to deal with those, just the more variable weather patterns that we're having.
Your decisions and the decisions you've taken over the last number of years, which have led to this situation where you're no longer in derogation, financially, do you feel optimistic about it? Do you feel that you're in you're going to be in a good position now?
Yeah, I think our focus is always on, I mean, first and foremost, if we're not making money, we're not running a farm. We wouldn't have, you know, we're at nothing. So first and foremost, in any of our decision making, it has to be around the financial aspect of it. Maintaining a margin on every single litre every year. And that's a key foundation for profitability in our business.
Jill O'Sullivan just outside Dungarvan, and before her you heard Kate Curran in Portlaw. And thanks so much to both of them for explaining how they are going to manage the challenges ahead. And obviously here's hoping for a good August and September for all the dairy farmers out there. Now, it is Reek Sunday tomorrow, when up to an astonishing 30,000 people are expected to climb Croagh-Patrick over in Mayo. And since the pandemic, there has been what can only be described as an explosion of interest in outdoor recreation. In Sweden, people have the right of public access to roam in just about anywhere in the countryside, as long as they don't disturb or destroy. But while we don't have anything similar here, we do have a very wide range of publicly funded schemes that have opened up walking trails across the country, up and down mountains. And it seems there is an insatiable appetite amongst the public for them. But how do we make sure our presence doesn't ruin the land and nature or the farming life in the fields? And how do landowners and farmers ensure that those who don't own land can still encounter nature and all the positive benefits that can bring? We are going to chat about that for the next 10 minutes or so. So from different parts of the country, I am joined this morning by, in Westport, Moira Kiley, CEO of Leave No Trace. From Glencree in Wicklow, by sheep farmer Michael Keegan. And from his farm between Newport and Mulranny in Mayo, by farmer Tony O'Donnell. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Moira, starting with you. I think Croagh-Patrick is a really interesting example of how the good and the bad. Obviously, back in the 1980s, I mean, it was nearly mined for gold, and then it became a tourist gold mine itself. It began to crumble away because so many people went up and down it. And then stakeholders came together in 2015. The path was repaired. It was rebuilt. And it's been a real success story, hasn't it, in terms of responsible walking trails and how we can make sure that our impacts aren't too great.
Absolutely. Croagh-Patrick really is a case study for just what can be achieved, even though, as you say, it was in a very difficult situation in terms of the access and the safety of the mountain was at risk of being closed at one point. So, look, it's incredible what has been achieved in a short space of time when the community and the stakeholders are supported, resources are put in place and they work together to restore the natural environment. And just walking up that mountain last week, you know, I am so inspired by the new trail, which is like a piece of art. Mm. And, you know, it's not just about sustaining the natural environment, but to me, it's about our natural heritage as well, that they have done an incredible job at, you know, making sure that we have that for future generations.
And tomorrow, your organisation is hosting an event called Love This Place. You're encouraging people to get out and about, as they have done in their droves, especially since the pandemic. But you're also encouraging them to have respect. And I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about the key issues. I mean, I suppose we're talking about the usuals here, controlling dogs. Don't leave litter. Stick to the path. Don't feed the wildlife like deer, for example.
Yeah, so National Love This Place Day is part of our Leave No Trace campaign that is running until the end of August. And it's being supported by many of the partners in outdoor recreation. And it's all about promoting responsible enjoyment of our natural heritage and outdoor spaces. And in recent years, we've been working to make sure it's established, you know, in the calendar as an annual call out to inspire individuals, communities and organisations to take simple action. So we have events taking place all over Ireland. And, you know, this year we've got three key calls to action. So we're asking people to stick to the path, making sure you're avoiding damaging habitats or disturbing farm animals. We're asking people to be responsible dog owner, keep your dog on a leash, and also to keep Ireland litter free. Make sure you bring your litter and your waste home and dispose of it responsibly.
Michael, just coming to you up in Glencree, I've been to your farm. It is utterly spectacular. And for anyone living in Dublin, you go there and you think this is, I mean, it's like a sort of film set. It's just beautiful. Did you notice a surge in visitors just after the pandemic?
Hi, Ella. Yeah, thanks. We did. Yeah, there's definitely been an increase in people using the uplands since the pandemic there. And I suppose with a growing amount of people using it, you're going to have a few people in that aren't responsible. You know, most people, to be fair, are pretty good, but you're always going to get an odd one that, you know, brings dogs out, lets them off the lead, throws rubbish around, or sometimes you'll get groups of people camping, leaving big piles of rubbish after them. You know, fires, lighting fires, all of the above.
And I suppose, as you say, it's important to say that most people are fine and behave well, but those that don't, they leave a kind of outsized impact on you.
They do, yeah. And it doesn't take very many bad experiences for landowners to just clamp down and say, look, that's it, we're not having. Because, like, why should we have to put up with bad behaviour? Like, after all, a farm, it isn't just your workplace, it's your home. And, you know, there's a part, you know, it's your home, but I mean, as a workplace, even there's dangerous things happening on farms. Sometimes you don't want people just roaming around the place.
And Tony, over in Burshall, you're involved in the walk scheme between Newport and Mulranny. What Michael says there, does that ring true for you?
It does. It's very important, I suppose, that in the relation, say, to commonage, and people often think, you know, the commonage is just free for all, but it's jointly owned by a group of people. And, you know, when you enter there, you have to show respect to the people that own that land. And also maybe a bit of background to the scheme that we're involved in. It's going on since 2008. It's administered through the Rural Community Development, and it's administered there in Newport by Martin Delane and his team in Southwest Mayo Development. And we sign up 5-year contracts that keeps us involved, gets us out there on 1 month a year in the section that we'd be on to go and, you know, to check that the route is properly maintained and also that it's clear of rubbish. And also while you'll be out there, you'd also meet people that'll be walking and you'll have conversations with them and you'll be able to, you know, give them a bit of the history of the area, but also to let them enjoy what's there. We are also getting paid as well.
You are. You've had it on your farm for 15 years. Is it fair to say in general it's been a positive experience for you?
It has been hugely positive because not alone it has brought people into the area and it's good for the local businesses, but it also, when you're out there, and some farmers don't meet a lot of people, they have meet up with people that have a different story to tell. It's good for their mental health. And I suppose it's just getting people out into rural Ireland.
Maura, I just wonder, listening to that, whether we might need to come up with some sort of countryside code of conduct. I mean, I'm just thinking, we have an overwhelmingly urban population and increasingly so. How do they learn about how to be in the countryside? You know, it's not the case where it would have been years ago where, you know, your auntie, your uncle or whatever had a farm in the Midlands and the West and you sort of grew up with it. Now, I mean, the majority of Ireland is privately owned. So how do you instill the idea in people that there's a certain way to be in the countryside?
I think this is really, really important. And it's something that we're working on at the moment through the work of Corlin Atua. And just addressing that, you know, the huge surge of people now going outside, particularly 98% of people now doing some sort of outdoor activity, with 55% of people doing new activities than they did before COVID. The outdoors has moved from niche to mainstream, and many of these people are new visitors. So absolutely, we would support that and are increasingly working with the farming community, the councils, the state agencies, to work at ways that can allow access to our natural environment in ways that respect it and respect the rights of landowners. And from our perspective, fundamental to that is, you know, that farmers and landowners are supported by investment that allows them to establish that access in a way that's managed, so that anyone crossing their land, you know, is aware of their responsibilities. And that's what we're trying to do with Love This Place Day and the National Love This Place campaign. But also what's really, really important is our educational systems and making sure that this whole ethos around stewardship in the outdoors is part of our core curriculum. And we're seeing a huge increase in that now, in terms of more and more schools, be it early years, are engaging in outdoor forest schools now. We're seeing it in primary schools. We're working with Picker Pals, who are in 60% of schools, to get the message of Love This Place out there now. So I think, you know, this cultural context of Ireland, particularly if, you know, if you compare it to Sweden, where, you know, they have had you know, this fruitsliv, which is called open air life in Swedish translation. You know, that's been an integral part of their life for centuries, where they've been enjoying nature and outdoors, you know, as part of their upbringing. But
I suppose it works both ways, doesn't it? And with, as I mentioned in the start, in Sweden, they do have, and it's impossible to have this discussion without mentioning the idea of right to access. I was interested last year, Fintan O'Toole wrote a piece about land access and the right to roam. He used Kirkpatrick as an example, that because it is private property, in principle, it could be stopped and the path could be blocked, even though an awful lot of public money has been poured into it. And obviously, that's not going to happen. And in fairness to the farmers over there, they've been incredibly collaborative in how they've done things. But as Fintan said, as things stand, we will end up investing billions of euro in projects that depend on nothing more stable than an individual goodwill of property owners. So there is a kind of to and fro of that issue, isn't there, Maura?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, more than ever, it's really important that everybody is working together and on that same page. And we're seeing, you know, as you say, really positive examples of that happening across the country. And we want to continue this dialogue and partnership with the farming interests to develop more workable solutions to benefit everyone, but more importantly, to protect those property owners' rights to the natural environment and make sure that, you know, people can enjoy access to the outdoors.
And just briefly, Tony, a countryside code of conduct, does that sound like a good idea for you?
Yes, I think that would be good to consult with all the stakeholders. You know, I suppose with farming, from their side, they're concerned about their livestock. They're also concerned about fencing, maybe, and the way people park. But also, I suppose everybody has to buy into it as well, and that they feel that they're getting some product there, you know, that they're getting a public good. They're looking at this, and like in the North Shore, Clubay here, we have 12 trails there. It's something that's going to increase the amount of jobs in our area as well, as people use it. But the code of conduct, I suppose it has to be properly explained to farmers and also to the users.
Okay, well, listen, farmer Tony O'Donnell in Mayo and Michael Keegan in Wicklow, thank you both very much. Maura, very briefly, just to mention, you're doing a swim to Clare Island in early August to raise money for Westport Autism Friendly Town Group, I gather.
Yeah, so I am chair of the local group, and 2.5 years ago, my son was diagnosed with autism, and I have had an incredible journey with him by bringing him into the sea. And in terms of the benefits of the outdoors, not just for myself, but for my son, in terms of sensory stimulation, you know, it's been transformative.
And the swim is sorry to interrupt you, but the swim is in early August. And just briefly, Maura, for people who want to donate, where do they go?
Oh yeah, you can visit Facebook, Westport Autism Friendly Town Facebook and Instagram pages.
So unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Best of luck with the swim. Thank you all so much for joining me this morning. Maura Kiley, Michael Keegan, Tony O'Donnell. 51551 on text, countrywide at rte.ie. We'll be back after this.
Email countrywide at rte.ie.
Tesco Club Card gives you the power to more. Grill out with 3 for €10 from our fire pit range. Spice up your dinner with Old El Paso kits and select a Coke 4-packs, any 2 for €6. Plus 7-Up Zero and Pepsi Max 18-packs were €16.50, now €10 each. Get more from your shop with your Tesco Club Card or app. Shop in-store or online. Tesco. Every little helps. Subject to availability, prices vary in express stores. Deposit may apply. See tesco.ie.
This weekend in the Irish Times. It's exhilarating, it's scary and dangerous. Aidan Gillen, star of Game of Thrones and Kin, talks to Roisin Ingle about his passion for performing. In Weekend, Owen Corry highlights the airfares flying under the radar with last-minute summer bargains, while Washington correspondent Keith Duggan analyses how Kamala Harris could win the race to the White House. And our all-star panel of Sean Moran, Malachy Clerken, Gordon Manning and Dean Rock preview the All-Ireland football final. Buy in store or get it delivered to your door. The Irish Times, because you get it.
RTE Radio 1.
Two amazing live shows at Galway Summer Series at Galway Airport this August. Madness with special guests Lightning Seed, Saturday, August 10th. And The Waterboys on August 18th. Don't miss Madness and The Waterboys live at the Galway Summer Series this August.
Shuttle services running to and from Air Square. See expressway.ie. Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
51551 on text. Well, the hats are coming out for the Galway races, which start on Monday. But for some in the West, the most excitement to be had is when jockeys and thoroughbreds kick up sand and spray during the races on Omi Strand in Claddaduff in Connemara. They've been part of the life for generations and are held every year. They were paused in 1963, revived in 2001, and they were again suspended during the pandemic in 2020. But this year, they are back on August the 4th, thanks in no small part to the determination of the main organiser, Fionn Mulcairn. Connemara breeder Joe McNamara and his daughter Emer are looking forward to the races. Between them, they have memories stretching back nearly 70 years. And they asked Lorna Siggins to call in to share them with her. But when she arrived, they were in the middle of a delicate operation with one of their stallions, who was about to mount a visiting mare.
So Ned now is going to meet.
Yeah, he'll meet his next girlfriend. Yeah.
Beautiful animal.
He's got a really good heart.
Has he?
Yeah, oh, he does.
He's lovely.
He's like he's older now as well. He's 15.
So does he know he's about to meet a girlfriend now?
Yeah.
Oh, he does?
Yeah. Once the season starts from March time on, it doesn't matter. If he hears an engine, he'll start neighing. Because he's like, oh, who's coming to see me? Yeah.
Caesar, yeah. Anyhow, that's the story. Omi
was a great novelty because it was on the sand, you know, especially when you were young, to be, you know, this big, vast desert of sand in front of you. Plus, it was away from home and you mightn't know the locals, so it was all excitement as a young lad.
And of course, there were sports and tug of war and all sorts of
things. Oh, there was all sorts, yeah. All the old boys would be, they'd set up a bar. And that have barrels and that have planks on the thing and that have a big square and the big jugs of water and that kind of thing. They'd be filling them up with jugs into the glasses and a lot of the lads would be just getting the bottles of stout. And of course, all these old fellas, you see, they didn't drink socially, do you know? It was totally one-off thing, once, twice a year, they'd get out, you know, and escape. So, of course, it used to go to their head. And they'd be thrown off with jackets and fighting. So a lot of people would go just for that. You know, in that song...
You can sing it if you like.
Yeah,
if you
come to me now one second, I'm just trying to think. The bacon is hung from the ceiling, sure the story I tell you is true. You know, when the wheeling and dealing was over everybody stayed on for the fight. Well, the horse racing was a bit like that as well, you know.
You did have a situation where once a horse rode into the sea.
That was only, oh God, I was very, very small. And this guy, he actually came from Roundstone Hill, so I knew him. So he asked me, would I ride his horse? And I said, well, of course I'd ride his horse. I was delighted. So I lined up. Everything was lovely. There was seven or eight or whatever was in it. You kind of start on the straight and away you go. So you've got about 100 yards before you hit the first bend. So we hit the first bend and all the others, made their turn. But mine didn't. He kept going straight and straight for the sea. He just had no mouth. Just, you know, you couldn't control him. You know.
And how far did you go into the sea?
Well, I was going to say up to my neck, but no. No, about... I was going to bail out, and I said, no.
So you stuck with him, and he...
Oh, back he came, but he then tried him in another race later on, so I was kind of waiting for it, but I still didn't get around the corner. I remember the man named Fesney, who owned the horse. Yeah. You know, but horses were much, much fitter back in those days. There was more native pony in them. So they had that little bit of hardiness, and plus they were working all week, so it was a day off for them in a way. Yeah. To move on then to modern times, different scene. The horses now are thoroughbred horses, and they would have raced on different racetracks, different standard, good horses. You see, this racing originates because back in the day, the ordinary Joe Soap didn't have a horse, and he couldn't race a horse. So this is how the flapping got set up and how pony racing kind of evolved, because it was the poor man's racing. It was the poor man's Epsom and the poor man's Corra, you know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And Dingle was like Cheltenham.
Dingle would be the king of the pony racing. To win in Dingle is like winning in Cheltenham.
And Emer,
yeah.
You have ridden then in Omi. So what age were you when you rode there first, do you remember?
It would have been the first year of the revival. They had a Connemara pony race. And it was all Connemara ponies that we had at that time. I was fortunate enough to have a little Connemara mare that she thought she was a racehorse. She was trapped in a pony body. So I suppose I was really excited to get to go to ride in a race. And finally, there was something that was kind of more up our alley. She won that Connemara pony race 3 years in a row. But
the thing about it, she did it with style.
Yes.
She looked good.
Do you remember her name?
Mafia. Was
Mafia.
Her name. Mafia was her name. I don't think we've come across a pony quite like her since.
No, she was a very clever pony. Very, very clever.
Mafia was the root of, I know it kind of revived your...
It did, because you see, all of a sudden, I was back in my childhood, the race, and it was back when I was a kid, exactly the same thing. Here we were, going to Womey to a race, and Emer didn't like the course. And
The first year, I think it would have been probably 14, 13 or 14. Every year she was winning it by that little bit further because, you know, I suppose we were learning, my dad was telling me how to, you know, to have her fit and, you know, to train her and this kind of thing. So
it was the start of the revival of the racing for us, me, and for then, of course, Emer and our other daughter, Kate. She fell in to line as well, and we travelled the bloody country and cost a fortune from Dingle to Donegal racing. You know, it just gets you. It's the excitement is brilliant, you know.
Yeah, brilliant. And from there then, I suppose, we went to Tattersall Sales and we bought kind of the our first thoroughbred.
What happened then?
I thought Matthew was fast until I got on a thoroughbred, right. And that was next level. Yeah.
Riding on a strand like that, you're getting sand.
Oh, yeah, the horses will be covered in sand.
Yeah.
The horses, their eyes and their ears and everything, even the nostrils, their nostrils open until they get the air in. They're full of sand. Yeah.
And you as well.
Yeah,
the jocks are covered.
You'd have,
totally covered.
And the races on the beach, you'd have tights, a pair of tights over that would cover your nose and then your goggles. So it's kind of lessening the kickback as much as possible.
Okay.
A pair of tights. The sand kicking into your face, it stings. Yeah. It's sore.
Yeah. But the crowd must be great as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's no feeling. And I suppose we trained out there. So, you know, you'd be very comfortable on the day when you'd be training and you could be there and you'd be stylish and you'd be, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And then on the day of the race, and that kind of all goes out and your legs feel like jelly when you pull up and you just can't wait to go out and do it again.
Would you go this year?
It's in your blood. You can't help it. You know, you want to be part of it. You want to have a horse. You don't enjoy a race unless you have a horse.
I know that even a few weeks ago you were sending me adverts for thoroughbreds.
I've heard Omi.
Horse for Omi.
Might you be tempted, Emer?
I think I would. I would, yeah. I wouldn't need... I wouldn't need too much encouragement.
Mafia sounds like great crack. Joe McNamara and his daughter Emma are talking to Lorna Siggins about the OMI races, and they start at 12 noon sharp on August the 4th. And I was just looking there at the Irish Olympians. Amazing day, packed day ahead. Boxing, canoeing, cycling, rugby sevens, swimming, hockey, everything. But it starts at 8:48 a.m. with Sarah Ennis with the dressage event. So best of luck to her and Susanna Berry and Austin O'Connor, the team out there. Now, next week, curlew chicks hand-reared by scientists will be released into the wild as part of a project to save this species from extinction. There are just about 100 breeding pairs left in the country, so their future isn't looking too good. But farmers and scientists are trying their best to keep them going. There's a new publicly funded $25 million project led by Athlone ecologist Owen Murphy, looking at a better future for curlew and other breeding waders along sites in the West, the Northwest and the Midlands. And farmers will be paid to support these birds on their land. Good morning, Owen. And good morning, sheep and beef farmer Jim Flynn, just outside Drumshambo in Leitrim.
Morning, Ella.
Jim, I'm going to start with you. Remind me of your memories of the call of the curlew when you were younger.
Well, there was a lot of curlews in the areas down in the boglands, I suppose, them times. And if you were on the bog or if you were doing hay, if you heard the curlew call, and the old people would say, "Oh, the rain is coming." So that was going on nearly as the rain bird in them times. But it was no different than any other bird. There was plenty of them around, so
plenty of them. We have a little sound of the curlew call now. It's a very beautiful, haunting sound.
Yes.
There it is. There, and older people, you said, call them the rain bird. I never heard of that.
The rain bird. Well, maybe it was a thing, but it was all over Leitrim anyway, I know, because I was talking to a man last night and he said, yes, in North Leitrim it's the same thing. So why it was, I don't know. Maybe it was a sign of the rain. There's no forecast or anything much that time.
And when
it was
did
all
the,
a sign of rain.
For you, I mean, you've had them breeding on your farm, Jim, but when do you remember they started to disappear?
About 6 or 7 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. They were talking, there wasn't, I had noticed that there had gone very, very few of them. So I knew it was two pair, and I contacted the wildlife officer. He came out and we couldn't get them the first year, but the next year he came along, he paid a lure to call them. And yes, they reacted to the lure. So they were delighted, you know, that there was some left in the area all the time.
And Owen, you are coordinating this new $25 million project, which isn't just about the curlew. It is about breeding waders. I mean, there's something like 22 pairs of redshank left, 800 pairs of lapwing left in the country. So they all need a bit of help. The curlew, though, it doesn't help itself, does it? I mean, it needs a very particular kind of landscape that doesn't really exist in many parts of Ireland. But they also nest on the ground.
Yeah, Ella, this is the problem with this, I suppose, suite of species, the waders, as you refer to them. They have a number of things in common, and although they're different species and use slightly different breeding areas, they all nest on the ground. And I suppose that makes them extremely vulnerable to any pressure or any change that happens on the ground. So the big decline in most of these species has happened since the mid-80s. And a number of factors, I suppose, are driving that. But our changes in farming methods, the timing of what we do on farms, our forestry policies, I suppose, board pneumonia, and our commercial peat production has removed some of our pristine bogs. So there's various pressures. And I suppose you talked about it a little bit earlier on the show as well. Recreation is also, you know, so there's pressures from all sides on these birds. They would have originally developed this technique to breed in wide open landscapes, and what they used for defence was camouflage and evasion. So they would have, you know, they're a very wary bird, they're very cryptic, so they hide. Both their eggs themselves and their young are very, very well camouflaged into pristine habitats and landscapes. So anything that changes that landscape or habitat will have a knock-on effect on these birds.
And when we think of predators, Owen, we're thinking about the fox,
the crow, the mink, these are species that will eat the chicks and the eggs on the ground.
Yeah, we refer to these those species as generalist predators. So I suppose any animal that's a generalist and can adapt and take food from various different sources tends to do better than those who are very specialised. So foxes, as we know, I mean, it's a most magnificent animal and extremely intelligent, and you know they can eke out a living in various parts of the country. So as we change landscapes, and I suppose maybe blocks of forestry, or in some instances where farming practices may have stopped, that scrub and woodland starts to build back up again. These harbour a lot of these animals. They like woodland. They like scrub for their dens. Mink are a non-native. So these predators, I suppose, just have the upper hand at the moment because of the landscape that they're in.
About 7 million of the 25 million will go to farmers for measures to support breeding waders. Jim, just talk a bit about what you will do as part of this project.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to compensate farmers. There was no compensation this year, so we have to acknowledge that the farmers was very agreeable. We'll have to say that for them, because we had up a net around in one man's in the middle of a meadow where there was a breeding curlew. And we had it there for 3 weeks, and he didn't put out fertilizer, or he was very agreeable. We could walk down through his meadow, and other people then, where we walked through meadows checking to see could we get a fine nest, there was no problem with the farmers. So it would be nice to be able to acknowledge that to the farmers, that there would be a few pounds going or a few euros going to them. But for us, it's just a matter of trying to, if we get a nest, to fence it, and that's it, and try and keep down the predators to a certain level.
That's the big one. Owen, just finally, I mean, do you feel optimistic? It's sometimes hard to feel optimistic for the future of the breeding curlew in Ireland, but do you feel optimistic that it can find a sort of a bit more of a stable footing in Ireland?
Yeah, I certainly am optimistic. I suppose with the level of funding that is now going into projects such as the Breeding Wader EAP, and we will be working in partnership with Acres, with Acre CP teams, with the like of Corncraig Life, Life on Macare. So there's lots and lots of different projects at the moment. And I think collaboration is probably the key. If we can get these projects to work together so that a Breeding Waders EAP is building on top of work that has already been done by Acres or by National Parks and Wildlife Service farm plans, well, then there is some hope. And I suppose where we still have breeding populations at the moment, it's key that we stabilise those populations in those core areas. And then as greater change happens over the landscape, maybe they will get to repopulate certain other parts of the country. But as Jim said, we're reliant on farmers. Instead of seeing it as a compensation, I see it as payments for delivering a service. These farmers, if they sign up to projects such as these, I look at it as like a biodiversity dividend, and it may be appealing to farmers in this particular time, with fluctuations in prices, high input costs and climate change, the resilience you talked about earlier in the programme, payments for implementing the services that are protecting these birds may become part of what farmers rely on as their yearly incomes.
Okay, well listen, best of luck with it. We'll stay in touch with you about the project. Owen Murphy there in Athlone and Jim Flynn in Leitrim. Now, John Connell is a writer and farmer from Longford, where he lives with his wife, Viv, and their young son, Ted. This morning, he recounts a road trip that he and his wife, Viv, took recently. A journey that in one way began in Longford and ended in Dublin, but in another way began in Vietnam in the 20th century and ended in Ireland in the 21st. I'll let him explain this himself.
What does it mean to be Irish? What does it mean to belong? What does this land we stand upon say about ourselves, and how does it shape us? These were all the questions my wife and I asked each other last week as we made our way to Dublin. We were on a special trip, a long-awaited day when my wife Viv, a Vietnamese Australian, would become an Irish citizen. We left the farm early and drove on the busy roads to the convention centre to be greeted by hundreds of people waiting to enter the building. They were, I realised, her fellow would-be citizens. They were the face of the new Ireland. Some, I supposed, had fled wars. Others had come to build a new life. They were all united in the same purpose that morning. There was a great magic to it all, a great excitement. In the building, the applicants and their guests were separated to fill out one last piece of paperwork. It was, I reasoned, the last time Viv and I would be separated like this. In the auditorium, we took our seats, me in the back and she in the front, with the now 1,000 or more people to be enrolled. A band struck up some popular melodies while we waited, and soon the ceremony was underway. A minister spoke, a judge enrolled them, and in no time we were all standing to hear the national anthem. It was over, I suppose, in an hour, and yet everything had changed in that time. Viv, like the 1,000 other people, was now Irish. She looked the same, but in speaking after, amidst the smiles and handshakes, I knew she felt different. This was the end of a journey. Viv was still a proud Vietnamese-Australian woman, but she was also now Irish. She said that she felt she had not left anything behind, but rather had gained something more. She was a dual citizen and could rightly hold on to both cords. That's the beauty of the new Ireland that is being built. You can hold on to your past and embrace your future. I felt an enormous feeling of pride that day, not just for Viv, but for the country that we all have created in the form of Ireland, a land that welcomes, a land of opportunity. It was not that long ago that we were the ones leaving in droves to all the four corners of the earth. The judge who enrolled everyone into their citizenship advised that we write down about the day, that we remember it, that stories, family stories, are important. My wife was the daughter of Vietnamese refugees who fled a war and moved to Australia. She in turn came to a farm in the Irish Midlands and is now Irish. All this within two generations. There is more to be wrote, of that I am sure. We will write it together, she and I. It is the story of our life.
Writer and farmer John Connell, and many congratulations to Viv and all the new Irish citizens. John's latest book, 12 Sheep, is published by Allen and Unwin. Well, that's it for this morning. The producer was Eileen Herron. The broadcast coordinator was Mary Elizabeth Bruton. And on sound was Harry Buckless. Until I talk to you again, have a very good weekend.